It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We've all heard the reference, the Rorschach test. Perhaps you've used it in casual conversation when you want to indicate something that elicits a variety of interpretations among different people. Or perhaps you've actually taken the Rorschach test as a clinical test. Well, my guest this hour is Damien Searles. He's author of Ink Blots, Herman Rorschach, His Iconic Test, and The Power of Seeing. In it, Searles documents Rorschach's groundbreaking contributions to modern psychology, as well as the surprising and enduring afterlife of Rorschach's work as the ink blots spread out of the clinic and into our cultural imagination. Damien Searles is also a well-known French and German translator, as well as the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship. He joins us for the hour. Damien Searles, what a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
I'd like to start, before we get to the test and how it was developed and how it was became embedded in our culture up to today, I'd like to talk about this man, Herman Rorschach, because we really don't hear much about him. In fact, is this the only biography, did I read correctly, of him?
Yep, that's right. There's never been a biography, even in German. There was one article in the 50s, and then the trail seemed to have died out. You know, when I started this, I was in the same situation. I didn't know Rorschach. Is it a person, place, or thing?
Mm-hmm.
But Herman Rorschach was a person. He was born in 1884 in Switzerland. He was a trained psychiatrist. Probably the most important thing about him was that he was a visual person. His dad was a drawing teacher. He was a lifelong amateur artist. And he was very respectful and in touch with how much it says about you, how you see things in the world. I mean, it also is probably important that he looked like Brad Pitt. That was one of the exciting things I discovered.
I see that right on the book. It's almost a mirror image of a Brad Pitt with the tousled hair as well.
Before the book came out, if you typed Herman Rorschach into search engine, the first thing that would come up would be some separated at birth pictures with Herman Rorschach on one side and Brad Pitt on the other side.
He lived a very short life. He died in 1922 at the age of 37. So take us back into his short life and tell us about how his artistry became enmeshed in his interest in the mind.
So he grew up in relatively modest circumstances. As I say, his dad was a teacher. Both his parents died when he was a teenager. And so he decided to become a doctor and eventually a psychiatrist just out of an ambition to help people. He was actually really a great guy, which you don't sometimes find when you're reading or especially writing a biography. There's usually a lot of dirt to dig up, but he was actually just really modest and hardworking and supportive of his wife and younger sister, and it was nice to spend time with him. So he became a psychiatrist. He studied in Zurich, Switzerland, which was actually really the prime time and place for the development of modern psychiatry and psychology. Freud had published, but he was this sort of fringe figure off in Vienna. It was Rorschach's own teachers, Carl Jung and a man named Bleuler, who were the most important people in Europe for taking Freud's ideas and really bringing it into modern medicine and hospitals and the scientific establishment. So he learned the cutting edge, but at the same time was enough of an outsider to be able to sort of use it or refuse it in his own way. There's one letter he wrote that I like where he jokes with a colleague of his that in Vienna they're going to be explaining the rotation of the world, the rotation of the earth psychoanalytically before long at this rate. So, you know, he had a sort of humorous distance at the same time as he was using it. So he was working in hospitals. He was working with some people who were, you know, very seriously psychotic. You couldn't put them on a couch and talk to them for an hour a day. So he would try and reach them in other ways. And being a visual person, they'd sometimes be visual ways. He'd give them art supplies and things like that. And then he realized that he could come up with this test of how they see things, and that that would give him insight into their psychologies.
Mm-hmm. So here we have a really difference between sort of Freud and Jung here. Or perhaps those familiar names did use this. So Freud would say it matters what you say, and here he says how you see things, your perception, that reveals how your mind works. Is that the key difference here?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. When Rorschach came up with these ink blots, he originally didn't call it a test at all. He called it a perception experiment. He was just studying how people approach the task. Do they start with the whole image and then home in on details, or do they sort of build up a big picture? Some of the images have color. Does the color focus people's attention, or does it sort of distract from their ability to interpret the shapes? He was really just studying how different people go about it. There was this amazing anecdote from when he was in college. He was kind of a broke college student who couldn't afford to go to restaurants or the theater or anything. So he'd go to the art museum in Zurich with his friends. And afterwards, he'd ask all his friends what they each thought of a given painting they had seen. So even back then, he was just sort of curious how different people see things differently. And he only realized later that it's not just an experiment that measures how people see things. It is a test, because patients with different problems, or even people with different personalities, really went about the task differently. Mm-hmm. And so it did turn out to be a test.
You mentioned that he gave his patients, as a psychiatrist, as an MD, art supplies. What did he have them do with these art supplies?
Well, he was just doing various things, you know, as he went on his rounds. Sometimes he had a couple of hundred patients in his care that he would check in on every day, and many of them would be non-responsive or catatonic or something like that. But he would try to see if he could make some sort of connection with them. He himself was a visual person, so he used to take photographs of the patients and sort of organize them. He drew these great drawings in the files of the hospital, things like that. But he would also, he heard that someone used to be an artist, so he would leave art supplies for them. And then sure enough, this non-responsive patient the next day would have a drawing he'd made. Or he'd give them paper mache and have them make little models of heads or things like that. My favorite story is that he had a monkey. He had sort of seen this troupe of traveling theater players with a monkey and said, "Hey, can I borrow that for a couple months?" And then took the monkey around with him to visit all the patients, just to sort of see what would happen, to make some kind of personal connection with the patients.
Mm-hmm. This is interesting. Your book gives a picture of, well, we have a cliche picture of a person of this era interested in the mind, a dark, brooding, introspective person interested in the darkest recesses of our minds. But that doesn't seem to be what you're describing here in Hermann Rorschach.
No, I mean, his patients loved him. His colleagues admired him. He was a good guy.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, well, as long as we're talking about his life, how does his life end at 37 years?
Well, he invents the test a century ago this year, 1917. It takes him a while to get it published because World War I is ending and there are paper shortages and it costs a lot to print things in color and things like that. But fortunately, that gave him more time to really sort of deepen and enrich his use of the test, his data collection, and his sense of what the test can do. So it finally gets published in 1921, and then April 2nd, 1922, he dies. It was appendicitis, which is kind of crazy because he was a medical doctor. His wife was a medical doctor. He's living in a hospital where he works. But there was this kind of cloud of tragic coincidences that meant that he didn't get his horrible stomach pain checked out in time. And he died in the operating room of an infection from the burst appendix.
If you've just joined us, Damien Searles is my guest, author of The Ink Blots, Herman Rorschach, His Iconic Test, and The Power of Seeing, which tells a story, as we've been talking about it. Herman Rorschach lived in early in the 20th century, and the Rorschach test, as Damien pointed out, he started from ground zero, as I think many of our listeners do, Damien, that Rorschach, what is it, a man? Where did this funny name come from? Let's talk a little bit about the test. I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. If you have a question about the Rorschach test, we're going to be talking about it clinically right now, and then its cultural significance, also in journalism, why we may use that, why you may have used that within the last week as a reference. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you've even taken the Rorschach test as a clinical test. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about the test, Damien. Tell us the story of how Herman Rorschach developed the test as a clinical tool. How did that start?
Well, I think there are a couple misconceptions about the test that I certainly had going into this that it's important to realize aren't true. So, you know, I kind of had this idea from old movies that it was some sort of magic, like, truth serum thing that, you know, the doctor shows you this smear and suddenly you're saying, I see the murder weapon that I hid in the third drawer, you know. And that was, I had this very kind of hokey idea about what the Rorschach test is, which of course makes it seem pretty implausible. The two things that I think are most important to know are, first of all, that it's not mostly about what you see, it's about how you see. So, it's not like if I see a frolicking butterfly in a meadow, that means I'm a good and happy person. And if I see an axe murderer, that means I'm a violent criminal. That's just not how it works. It actually, the responses you give are sort of scored based on, do you see them as alive or as still? Do you see the whole picture or details? Do you see mirror images or do you see it as a whole scene? These kind of objective, formal qualities of how you approach the task of saying what you see in these ink blots. And, you know, that just immediately makes the whole thing a lot more plausible, mm-hmm. right? If you can't put together complicated information in a way that makes sense the same way that, like, most average people can, then you may have some cognitive problems. Like, that's pretty reasonable thing to say. And immediately it sort of gets away from this kind of hocus-pocus idea. Mm-hmm. The other really important thing is that they're not new ink blots that you or the doctor make every time you take a Rorschach test. They're 10 and only 10 images that Herman Rorschach himself, who was a talented artist, made and sort of used trial and error to put in a certain order. And it's those 10 that are still shown in the same order 100 years later. That is what the Rorschach test is. And those 10 images actually work better than ink blots that you or I could make. They really are right on these tipping points of, you know, it's possible to approach it one way and it's also possible to approach it another way.
Mm-hmm. It might be interesting to invite our listeners to just look online, use a search machine and look at the images that you're talking about. There are only 10 of them. I'm looking at them printed out right now. And I mean, you very clearly see them things. I see here's Rorschach test, final card, number 3. Looks to me, Damien, like two drummers opposing each other. Then I look down, it looks like it's called two waiters bowing in a certain interpretation.
You know, that raises a couple things. First of all, I'm glad you say that. They really do have this visual kind of interest and excitement about them. If you or I made a blot and we looked at it, then, you know, we could force ourselves to say, okay, maybe it's an owl, but it wouldn't really look like that. And if we looked at a real picture, you know, even a cartoon, if we look at Charlie Brown facing sideways on a street with one foot raised, then we're all going to see that as moving. I mean, he's obviously walking. He's not standing with one foot raised. And that doesn't sort of tell us anything about our way of seeing, because the image is just either clearly what it is, or in the case of the smear, it's clearly nothing. But the thing about these 10 ink blots is they really kind of do look like two drummers, but they're not really holding the drum the right way, and they have these body parts that are in sort of wrong places or not really attached to each other. So there really are all these different parts of the image you can pay attention to and all these different ways you can pull it together or not pull it together. So it really does work a lot better than just any old ink blots. Most of the ones we see in ads or movies or music videos or whatever it is are not the real images, partly because there are only 10. So it's actually pretty controversial that you could just go and print out 10, or that listeners could just go to the internet and look it up. A lot of psychologists are upset that that's possible. But the data seems to show that it doesn't ruin the test, because, you know, it's not about giving your first impression. It's just about how do you tackle the challenge of saying what you see in these images.
I want to get to, Damien, to the design of these 10, what you call real Rorschach inkblot test images. What do we know about Hermann Rorschach's thinking? Why these 10? Why these certain designs?
For all of the sometimes very personal and human biographical information I was able to dig up in writing this book, that is a bit of a black hole. There are just no personal letters for the 18 months kind of bracketing when he made it. There are no dated drafts or notes like, oh, I realized today I need to add red. You know, there's just none of that. And there are a few things he said after the fact about, for example, why it helps that it's symmetrical. But it kind of just is this lightning flash eureka moment where in the space of only a few months, he suddenly has the 10 images in the right order, doing more or less what he is going to say later that it's doing. I mean, he really just artistically, intuitively, intelligently came up with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, of course, he had to use the same 10 on everybody. Otherwise, it would not be a reliable measurement. So he just stuck with those and started deepening his use of them.
So let's say, Damien, I go in 1921, I guess it would be late 1921, shortly before his death, Hermann Rorschach's death. I'm a patient. I go in. He suggests I take this test. What's going to happen to me? What is the procedure, that, as far as you could tell?
More or less the same as what it would be today. So he would say, you know, I'm going to show you some images, and I want you to just tell me what you see. So that's kind of important. He doesn't say make up a story. He doesn't say what do you imagine. He doesn't say, you know, how do you feel about this. He's just interested in your perception. He says, what is this? What might this be?
Mm-hmm.
One by one, he'll show you the cards, and he tries to sort of direct you as little as possible. So if you ask questions, he'll sort of deflect them and say, oh, different people see different things. You can do whatever you want. Instead of using a stopwatch to sort of time your responses, he's aware that that would sort of influence how you go about the task. It was very important to him to just make it as kind of impersonal as possible. He wouldn't put the numbers, like the card numbers on the front where you could see it, because that would, you know, make especially paranoid people being like, card three, three what? What does that mean? And like not pay attention to the perception anymore.
Yeah.
So just one by one, he'd ask you what you see and write down whatever you say, whether it's one answer or whether it's 20 answers.
And
then afterwards, after it was all done, he would go back and sort of read back through your answers just to sort of say, okay, where did you see the crab? Like, what was the drum exactly? And then he'd go off by himself and give each answer codes, as I said, based on is it about the whole card, does it use the color, whatever it is. And then it's with those codes that he would sort of come up with ratios and just a few simple calculations, like what percent of your answers are about animals, stuff like that. And then that's it. He would interpret that set of, you know, 10 or 15 numbers coming out of the test.
To what degree was were the results, what he saw in your perception of these ink blots, for him a work in progress? Or was there, before his death, a time when he had this test and he had reached a point where he said, this is the test and I can evaluate anyone with it?
The answer is sort of both. This was the test, and he was good at it, and he was able to do things like get a protocol, which is basically the answers written down by somebody else giving someone the test that Rorschach had never met. And he could just get the written record of it and try to interpret it and then check with the person's doctor. And sure enough, he would find that he was able to do it quite accurately. He was a little ambivalent about that. He thought it looked a little bit too much like a parlor trick. So that wasn't his main argument. But in terms of practice and training and sort of checking the test, that was something he would do a lot. He tried as quickly as he could to get a large sample size and to get away from whatever subjective criteria he started with. I mean, when he first invented it, obviously there was nothing else he could do but to say, you know, in his own mind, well, do I think this looks like a crab? Very quickly, he tested hundreds of people and so shifted from saying, you know, I personally think this is a good answer, to saying, well, fewer than 1% of people who've looked at this card, you know, say that. So it's a very unusual answer. And so, he had come up with these cards, but then very quickly sort of showed himself as the responsible, objective scientist that he was. There's this one very moving letter, I think. A colleague of his who worked in the education system in Germany was pressuring him to adopt the test as sort of aptitude testing, as a kind of SAT. Mm-hmm. And Rorschach wrote back to him and said, hold your horses, you know, maybe it will be good for aptitude testing someday, but when I imagine someone whose lifelong dream was to go to university or medical school being prevented by this test, I feel like I can't breathe,
okay,
wrote in this letter.
Damien Searles, you need to hold your horses, politely asking you to do that as we take a short break, and we'll come back talking about your fascinating book, The Ink Blots, Hermann Rorschach, His Iconic Test, and The Power of Seeing. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more discussion of Rorschach, Hermann Rorschach, the man, and his iconic test in just a moment. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A fascinating conversation with Damien Searles. He's got a biography out. It's called The Ink Blots, Hermann Rorschach, His Iconic Test, and The Power of Seeing. We're talking about where this test came from and who created it and what it was supposed to reveal. Talking about that in the first half hour, you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you'd like to email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Looking at the cover of this hardback edition, I see, as we pointed out in the first half hour, Hermann Rorschach, a dead ringer for Brad Pitt here. If it's ever made into a movie, Damien, they won't have much trouble there, will they, trying to pick someone? He died, unfortunately, at the age of 37 in 1922, shortly after creating this iconic test. And we talked a little bit about the development of it, Damien, in the first half hour. What was the thinking behind it? How it combines, intersects artistry, science, perception in a fascinating way. We want to talk a little bit about how it's seen in more modern times and how accurate it is. And let's invite one of our listeners, Earl, on. Earl in Des Moines. I see on my screen, Earl, you are a psychologist.
I am. I've 35 years out of Baylor and was actually trained on the Rorschach from John Exner at the beginning of my career.
Mm-hmm. So I want to, of course, ask our biography here, but you, with 35 years of experience, how have or have you used the Rorschach test?
I did for about 5 years after my training. I haven't seen anyone use this in over 20 years. Since 35 years ago, psychology has become much more of a science-based practice. And the Rorschach never met the level of scientific scrutiny that we now require for assessment instruments and for treatment approaches.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it does indicate, if anything?
It certainly shows quite a lot of creativity. Back when I was familiar with all of the research on this, the only thing I saw that was compelling was a study out of South Africa that showed that it was a fairly decent intelligence test, and that the complexity of the answers often mirrored the intelligence of the person taking it. But all the rest of it, I'm not saying it can't be accurate. I'm only saying that it never met the standards of scrutiny that we now require. And that's going through what's called meta-analysis, looking across studies, not just a single study.
Earl, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much for calling in. It leads into, something that I run across a lot, which is that people's ideas about the Rorschach test, even often psychologists, are not always entirely up to date. So there was a big book called What's Wrong with the Rorschach that came out in 2003. And to this day, when sort of popular media wants to interview an expert on the Rorschach test, they tend to get one of the co-authors of that book who says, yes, it's been debunked, but unfortunately, it's still used. The fact is, though, that's almost 20 years ago. There was a gigantic meta-analysis, like you mentioned, that was published in Psychological Bulletin, the number one journal in the field, in 2013, that really answered the criticisms that you're talking about and that this book, What's Wrong with the Rorschach, brought up. Throughout the sort of scores and usages that were not backed up and put the rest of them on very solid footing to the point where even the co-authors of What's Wrong with the Rorschach, who had said the Rorschach test should never be used in courtrooms or clinical settings until there's solid scientific evidence, responded to this 2013 article by saying, okay, well, we withdraw our call for a moratorium because this is the evidence we were looking for. They called it an unbiased and accurate reflection of all the research. Mm-hmm. So as of 2013, if what you're going for is scientific evidence, it's pretty clear that it actually does meet modern scientific standards.
Thank you so much for your call from Des Moines and the experience that comes behind your question and your comment. Earl, thanks.
You're welcome.
So tell us, what, even though you talk about the data that backs it up now, take us back perhaps a few years to the heyday of when
right.
the Rorschach test was used and where it became especially popular, for instance, right here in North America.
Absolutely. It's kind of horrifying to read about, but it makes for good reading to look back at all of the kind of crazy over-the-top uses that the test was put to. After Rorschach died, it really took off in America. It first came to America in 1925. It was given in Chicago for the first time. And by the late 30s, it had really taken over both the field of psychology, which was much more interested in kind of cultural differences, and anthropology, which was interested not just in, how people build teepees or whatever, but sort of the way in which their culture affects their personality. So by the 40s, you have the head of the Rorschach Institute and the head of the American Anthropology Association being the same person. The test is given all the time. Someone said that it had become as iconic for psychologists as a stethoscope was for doctors. And it was also being exported back out around the world by people studying cultures anywhere you can imagine, from tiny South Pacific islands to Native Americans in Canada to you name it. And that was when there would be these ham-fisted Freudian readings, like if you see a female torso instead of a male torso, you must be heterosexual, and if you see a male one instead of a female one, you're homosexual. Or it would be used in perfume ads, or it would be given to 1,000 Vietnamese peasants in the jungles of Vietnam during the Vietnam War so that the State Department could figure out, you know, why they don't like us. I mean, all of this kind of over-the-top use that really went far beyond what the scientific test itself could reasonably be expected to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was the reaction that Earl was talking about earlier. Starting in the 70s, the man who he mentioned as his teacher, John Exner, was the one who really sort of calmed it down and reinvented it for the sort of modern bureaucratic, quantitative, scientific world of modern medicine. He arguably didn't go far enough, and that's why there were these controversies more recently. But he did sort of set it on the path of saying, you know, this will stand or fall based on scientific studies of its validity.
Mm-hmm. You write in your book how it was even used at the Nuremberg trials of the Nazi criminals.
Yeah, so 1945, you know, you have all these leading Nazis in jail awaiting trial, and you have this brand new psychological method for uncovering the secrets of the personality. So what a gold mine. The prison psychologist and the prison psychiatrist in Nuremberg, just on their own volition, it wasn't ordered by lawyers or anything, they just decided to use this brand new technique to try and, you know, uncover the secrets of one of the most historically important groups of people they were ever going to run across. And so, yeah, Hermann Göring, sitting in solitary in his jail cell, gets a little visit from the prison psychologist who starts showing him ink blots.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, Damien. I'm just seeing a message that we just had a call from someone who works in the office of a clinician who still uses the Rorschach today, not available due to her work right now. But that begs the question, how widespread could you tell it is used today, and in what settings?
You know, I thought that would be one of the easiest questions to answer in doing the book, and it's actually one of the hardest. It's really hard to come up with hard numbers about how many people use it and where and when. There are all sorts of regional differences. You know, if there's a Rorschach expert at the graduate school that's trained all of the psychologists in the area, then it'll be used more in that area. As you've heard, the things people learn when they come out of school sort of shape their practice for the rest of their career. So it's really hard to put a number on how much it's used, and there are all sorts of local differences. It does seem clear that even though, as I said, the scientific footing is more solid than it's ever been, it's actually used much less than it was in its heyday. In the 60s, it was estimated that it was used about 1 million times a year in the U.S. alone. And it's certainly not at that level. But it's also not, you know, in the dustbins of history. There are lots of places and contexts where it will be used together with other psychological tests in any kind of evaluation, whether that's in a courtroom or for a job application to be a police officer, or in a clinical setting to diagnose someone, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's never used as this kind of magic bullet where you just give someone a Rorschach test and that's the answer. But if someone's giving you, you know, 10 tests to write up a comprehensive evaluation, then depending on where in the country you are, this might well be one of them.
Mm-hmm. Damien Searles is my guest. The Ink Blots, his book, Herman Rorschach, his iconic test, and the power of seeing. And so when I have you describe it, and we're having people call, talk about the use of it today, perhaps is there a stigma attached to it, even though there is some scientific evidence behind using this method? It doesn't seem to be, you don't put it in the bin with phrenology, bumps on the head, but there's something attached to it that maybe clinicians will not necessarily advertise that they use it or use it only in their certain circumstances?
I think that's exactly right. And I think probably a lot of people listening today sort of assume that it is like phrenology or truth theorem or something like that. I think part of it is because it's visual. You know, we have this sense that anything real has to be a hard number or, you know, maybe it can be a story. Stories are real in a different way. Maybe it's not scientific, but it's still real. But still, it's either going to be, you know, hard or soft. It's going to be numbers or words. And anything to do with art or visual stuff is sort of automatically subjective nonsense. There are people, you know, I ran across articles about people being given the Rorschach test and saying, what, I'm supposed to do art appreciation to decide, you know, if I deserve custody of my child? This is horrifying. I believe in science. I don't believe in this subjective art stuff. And I think that is a very built-in prejudice that a lot of us have. And that is one of the things that I really came away from this most impressed by, visual thinking and the visual approach that we all have to the world is meaningful and is scientific and is objective. It's not just art appreciation. You know, 85% of our brains are devoted to visual processing is one of the estimates I read. We are absolutely people who see things in a way that says something about who we are. And so if you could design a visual test that sort of calls upon enough of our visual powers, it makes sense that it would say something about us. But that's just not the way we usually think about art, I think.
Damien Searles, you say there are sort of three histories wrapped up in this book that you've researched and written, The Ink Blots, about Herman Rorschach and his iconic test. They kind of spill together, the history of psychology, the history of modern art, and then the cultural history surrounding Rorschach's popularity as a metaphor. Many of us have used it, especially journalists. Tell us about that aspect before the hour ends, how that became so appealing for journalists and others to use in perhaps casual conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, that's how I first heard the word Rorschach, some Supreme Court decision or sports result or wardrobe malfunction or whatever it is gets called a Rorschach test, meaning you can think whatever you want to think about it. We're not going to say there's any right or wrong answer. Whatever your response is valid, and it says something about you. I was really shocked to discover that metaphor of the Rorschach test only started in America and only started in the 60s. It didn't go back to the test itself because it's so built into how I think of the Rorschach test personally. But it was only when our culture sort of started becoming more relativist and having these anti-authoritarian rejections of, you know, who are you to tell me what I should think in the 60s, that the Rorschach test became this metaphor for that. You know, in a way, the real Rorschach test is the opposite of that. I call the last chapter of my book, The Rorschach Test is Not a Rorschach Test, because that's exactly what I want to say. You know, it's not just anything you want it to be. It's a real method that either works or doesn't to measure this or that, and you can prove it, and it has a history, and the images have real visual qualities. They're not just random. And, you know, in a way, what the real Rorschach test is a symbol for is that if I show you the card and you tell me what you see, a million other people have already looked at that card. There's all this data there. And I can now take the card out of your hands and look at the same image myself and try and see it through your eyes. It really actually is a kind of symbol for the way that people can come together. And even if they have different perspectives, it's perspectives on the same thing. That's not showing up in the newspapers yet, but that's how I like to think of the Rorschach test today.
Damien Searles, I mentioned earlier that a clinician where it's used here, who works at an office where it's used here in Iowa, was calling in. We actually have her on the line in Des Moines. Ava, we don't have much time, but tell us, it's used in your clinic?
Yes, it certainly is.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you can reveal this, with every patient in special circumstances, what can you tell us about how it's used?
Well, I'm an assessment psychologist, and so it happens more often in my practice than it might for other psychologists. And I certainly don't do it with everybody. It's not necessarily very helpful, but in cases where you need to understand somebody's personality in a different way than self-report. So the personality is a performance measure. I give these people a problem, and then I get to observe and score and interpret how they solve that problem.
Mm-hmm. And you see it as in this year, in the 21st century, 100 years after it was created, pretty much, as a valuable tool.
And becoming increasingly so, because I think that the research that they're doing is looking very good, and it's excellent research, quite different than what it's been in earlier years.
Okay, Ava, in Des Moines, thanks so much for making time during your working day to give us your perspective.
Sure.
I think that maybe one of the most important things Ava said is about self-report versus performance. In other words, most psychological tests, you answer questions or you fill in bubbles. You say what kind of person you think you are. But on a Rorschach test and other performance tests like that, you show what kind of person you are. Does the open-endedness of the task freak you out, or do you enjoy it? Are you playful? Are you rigid? Are you very mechanical? All these sorts of things, like an audition or a job interview, where you don't just ask someone how good a piano player they are. You put them in front of a piano and see how they do. And that's how people largely understand the Rorschach test today. You put people in front of this open-ended visual task and see how they approach it.
After all you've told us this hour, Damien, and we have about a minute left, it's just amazing that you are the first one producing a significant biography of Hermann Rorschach here. You must be amazed at that after discovering what you did and starting where you did.
I don't know what to say. I certainly think he's worthy of a biography. Partly a lot of the material is new, and a lot of the material that isn't new had been in the archives unpublished and untranslated. So it was my background as a translator that you mentioned at the start of the hour that sort of made it possible for me to not just read the scientific studies, but to sort of uncover all these sides of his life and his cultural background and really tell the story of how this test got made. I didn't come to this. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a crusader about personality testing or anything. But I was able to get access to the material that made it possible to really tell the story of Rorschach and the Rorschach test.
We have just 30 seconds left. Why does the story of Hermann Rorschach matter today?
Because not everyone's a word person, and everyone sees things in their own way. So psychology that really pays attention to that, just like advertising that does, is, I think, only going to be increasingly important in our modern world. And, plus he's this guy whose story has never been told and who's done something, created something we're still using a century later.
Damien Searles, it's been a pleasure having you on for the entire hour. The Ink Blots is his book, Hermann Rorschach, His Iconic Test and the Power of Seeing. So many things we didn't get to. Your research here, you mentioned just at the tail end. But I wish you well, Damien Searles, and thank you very much for this fascinating biography of Herman Rorschach.
Oh, thanks so much. It was great to talk to you.
River to River is produced today by Anna Williams. It's her last day. We will miss you, Anna, though we hope to have things in the future. You've been a treat to have around the office and contributed so much. Thank you, Anna Williams. Also produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.